All the sessions that I have done here, we've begun with some time of silence. And I guess really what I want to do is sort of persist in that. A time of agreed upon silence of about 2 minutes. Give us a chance to quiet down, get our minds quieted down. I don't know if your mind quiets down in 2 minutes or not. Mine rarely does. But I would like to begin reading some scripture, and it helps to hear the words of scripture, I think, if we do have some silence, and more than just a second or two. I noticed that each before the meals, the word always is, we'll have a moment of silence, and it literally is a moment or two. And here we'd like to take about 2 minutes. So let us, I'll say it again for those of you who haven't been here before. In keeping silence, we would like to be alert. It's not falling asleep. And silence, being alert, partly being alert is posture. And that means sitting erect, feeling your body in the vertical. And I suggest that you don't use the back of the chair, and that you don't use the arms of the chair, that you sit and let your body feel its own strength. Put your feet relatively close together, and then let your legs kind of relax and fall to whatever position that happens. Perhaps put your hands on your knees, or fold them in your lap, or whatever's comfortable for you. Keep your head erect, not bowed, not up, just in line with everything else of your body. Line it all up in that position, which I hope is comfortable for you. Let us begin with 2 minutes of silence. And to keep in mind, or be mindful of the fact that Jesus is specifically praying for you and for me in the high priestly prayer in the 17th chapter of John, when he says, "It is not for these alone I pray, but for those also who through their words put their faith in me. May they all be one. As thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, so also may they be in us, that the world may believe that thou didst send me. The glory which thou gavest me I have given to them, that they may be one as we are one. In them, I in them, and thou in me, that they may be perfectly one, that the world will learn that thou didst send me, that thou didst love them as thou didst me." I remember going on a retreat several years ago where the whole retreat was silent for about 3 days. And I can tell you that that's really an incredible experience. And if you have never had that experience and you have a chance to do it, do it. I wish I had the discipline to do it every year. I think it would be a real good thing to do. But after about 24 hours on a retreat of silence, your mind is so quieted down, it becomes very receptive. And a silent retreat doesn't mean that there's never a word spoken. There are words spoken. After about 24 hours, we came to lunch, and as we sat down and began to eat, someone slowly read Jesus' high priestly prayer. And I was very much struck by how new it sounded to me, and how the distractions of my mind, having been somewhat removed, I began to hear. In this high priestly prayer, Jesus, the portion of it that I read here, the emphasis is upon oneness, that we might be one. And that is not an end in itself. Spirituality is not being pious as an end in itself. It's not going around being looking more holier than thou, or all those kinds of things at all. And yesterday, the session that we had was on breathing, getting control of our breath, and a lot of what I tried to say behind that was to begin to experience our oneness with all things, Jesus asks the Father in this prayer that we might all be one, and that's what it's about. But not as an end in itself, because there is an in order that in here. And whenever I read Scripture and I come across the words so that or in order that, that triggers off in my mind right away that this is a means to an end, not an end in itself. And so did anyone catch here when Jesus said that they may all be one? Why? Pardon? No, not exactly.
Testimony to the world.
Right. Really, the fact that we are all one is witness to the fact that Jesus is who he said he was. That the world may, well, you got it right too. That the world may believe that you sent me. That's why the oneness. So it's not just an end in itself. Yesterday we did a meditation on a chair. Those of you who weren't here, we in a sense looked at a chair and realized that the wood of the chair has a history that goes back a million years, perhaps, or more, and is connected with everything in the entire universe. That there is an interconnectedness with the wood, the glue, the people who built the chair, the sun, the rain, the wind, and all kinds of things like that, that there is an inherent oneness in all things. And also yesterday I read from Colossians, the first chapter, where Paul talks about all things subsisting in Jesus, that he holds all things together. So again, there is that element of oneness. And if that's true of a chair, and this is why this is basically kind of a continuation, you didn't have to be here yesterday to catch some of this, but this is basically kind of a continuation of what we talked about yesterday. How much more so that's true of people. I said, probably there's nobody here now who heard this the last Tuesday, that one of my passions and one of the ways in which I have learned to see is through drawing. I like artwork. I like to paint and I like to draw. And there was a time in my life when making a good drawing was an end in itself. And there was a lot of pride hooked up in that and a lot of ego, and I like people. There's still some of that stuck away in me. Like people to look and say, that's a good drawing, and so forth. But now I've changed that a whole lot within myself. And for me, drawing is a way of seeing. And I guess I realized that long time ago, but didn't quite know what to make of it. I remember really looking deeply into the paintings of Renoir about 19 years ago, and realizing that the most important thing about art was that it helped me to see. Because at that time I had an infant son who was newly born. He's almost 20 years old now. And Renoir helped me to see my son. I really, his paintings of children, mothers and infants and what have you and so forth. Well, drawings like that for me, it helps me to see. And it could help you too. You don't have to be an artist. And one of the sessions I'll do next week, I think, will be connected with that, with seeing through drawing. Not drawing as art, but drawing as a way to help us to see. And my eyes are not as attuned as Renoir's. They're not as attuned as a great artist who's devoted their whole life to that is very deep. My eyes are fairly good, and I see interconnectedness even as I look in people's faces. Sometimes it's just sort of a little game that goes on inside of my head. But I met somebody here about 3 or 4 days ago. We got to chatting, and I think the person said to me, I am 100% Norwegian, or I'm 100% Swedish, or something. I forgot the nationality. It was one of those Scandinavian nationalities, and I think that's kind of neat to think that I'm 100% this or 100% that, but I know better. And you know better, perhaps, because when I look into people's faces, and I'm really centered, and I really see, and it is not just look. And there's a lot of difference between looking and seeing. When I really see, I see traces in everybody's face of the mystery of the genealogy of the person. I haven't figured this out on a calculator, but I think what I want to tell you is roughly accurate. If you go back about 10 generations in your history, you've got about 1,000 or over 1,000 ancestors. And if you go back in your genealogy and your history about 4 centuries, you've got something like 35,000 ancestors. That's staggering. So I look into a face, I often see that I see in many faces the traces of a black ancestor in all the white faces. I see the clue of something there, that in the 35,000 ancestors of your last 400 years, I can see that there is some black ancestry, some Mongoloid ancestry, some Caucasian ancestry. I see those things in people's faces, and I begin to, again, I sense how interconnected we are. So when we think I am 100% pure Norwegian, you're not. And you can't be. And it's almost impossible. That, in a sense, is also, I'm giving just tiny little clues as a sense of Jesus' high priestly prayer that we might all be one. Spirituality, then, is not a matter of being pious, of kind of being holier than thou. Yesterday, somebody said they had seen this book and read part of it, and I wanted to do the session that had to do with mindfulness, being always mindful. And Sean Caulfield, who's a Trappist monk, has a chapter in here called Awareness. And it's really kind of interesting. He said, out of presence, and I've used the word presence quite a bit, being present, out of presence comes awareness. Or this morning I would use the word mindfulness. Out of mindfulness comes vulnerability and availability to others. It's not an end in itself either. It's a matter of becoming open to be available and vulnerable to other people. He talks in this chapter about awareness, about somebody who would be completely aware and getting everything all together. Everything is perfectly integrated at all levels, that you would have quite a wonderful person, but you'd have a problem. He says, when you do meet such a person, you're apt to have a problem. That person may very well be a thorough and absolute bore, which I think is kind of interesting. He can exude a security like aftershave and is usually elected president of the board of directors. He's the obvious person to carry on business, civil or ecclesiastic, since he will never be tempted by wild mystical illogic. Will never try to do the impossible or smash the unjust to smithereens. The world somehow seems to need dull people for the sake of neatness. That kind of keeps us honest with what we're talking about with spirituality. For the Christian, it is seeing that all things are one in Christ. And for those of you who've been at sessions, more than one session now, you may suspect that, I don't know, I guess I'm really sort of avoiding trying to... consciously or unconsciously, I'm avoiding Christian language. It's just that I guess for me sometimes the words become dull on my ears because I've heard them so often. It's easy to snap right out there with, you know, well, what is the truth? Well, Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And we can give all these quick answers. I'm trying to just maybe say it in just a slightly different way. The Christian may say we are all one in Christ, but Jim Carroll has said in one of the little books he's done on contemplation that being a contemplative or is not that we see something that nobody else sees. And sometimes we have the image of the contemplative as someone who just sees something, wow, he's a prophet, he sees something no one else sees. That's not really what it's about. It's seeing all the same things that everybody else sees, but seeing them differently, or really seeing them rather than just looking at them. I think often we teach our children to look at externals, and then we place a value upon the external thing. Look at the toad, ugh, yucky toad. Look at the spider, ooh, he's a scary spider. Well, look at that one over there, how fat he is. And we get all of these externals on it. And so we're sort of teaching people to look, but never see anything. scriptures tell us that in Christ we are a new creation. All things are new. Well, the spiritual life is to begin to open our eyes and see. And all things, in fact, do become new when we begin to see them through the eyes of Christ, and that Christ is in us. We see things a new way. Well, let me give a couple of examples of this. This is something that I read in a book some time ago, but it finally has been very helpful to me. It's one of those things that sort of snapped me when I first read it. I thought, wow, there's something here. It's very simple. It's very almost sounds like nothing, but I've shared this with people, and I found that even after a year or two, somehow I'll meet someone that I had shared it with, and they will say, you know, that I've been trying to practice that, and it really has made a difference. This comes from a Vietnamese Buddhist monk named Thich Nhat Hanh. Thich Nhat Hanh got to be fairly prominent during our involvement in this war in Vietnam. He spent time in the United States. He is the monk that Thomas Merton, the Christian monk of our country, said, Thich Nhat Hanh is my brother, for he and I see things essentially the same way. Thich Nhat Hanh said, when he first became a Buddhist monk in Vietnam, and he lived in this monastery or what have you, he said that there would be sometimes 100 monks in the monastery, and when they finished eating, there would be 100 rice bowls to wash. And that was a big chore, all these rice bowls stacked up, and they didn't have hot running water, they didn't have scouring pads and all that kind of stuff. They had very simple things to try to wash the dishes. And he said, that was quite a job. Well, one day, Jim Forrest, who is an American involved in fact, I think right now he's the director of International Fellowship of Reconciliation, visited the pagoda where Thich Nhat Hanh was for a week or two, and they finished eating, and Jim said, well, let me do the dishes. I'd like to do the dishes. And Nhat Hanh said to him, do you know how to do the dishes? And Jim said, wow, come on. I mean, give me a little credit. That's my daughter's always saying that. Give me a little credit. Of course I knew how to do the dishes. Everybody knows how to do the dishes. And Nhat Hanh said to Jim Forrest, well, will you do the dishes to get them clean, or will you do the dishes to do the dishes? And Jim said, well, I choose the latter. And Thich Nhat Hanh said, okay, then you are ready to do the dishes. What he means by that is that when we do the dishes to get them clean and to get on to something else, we're not fully alive while we're doing the dishes. That the act of doing the dishes is a miracle in itself. And so often we are almost literally not alive while we're doing the dishes, because we're doing the dishes to get them done so that we can go sit at the table and drink tea with our friends. And so Thich Nhat Hanh, this strange little Buddhist mind of his, says we need to do the dishes to do the dishes. And I don't particularly enjoy doing the dishes, or I never did anyhow, but I found that little story is helpful to me. And I don't always think of it when I do the dishes, but I think of it quite a bit. And Thich Nhat Hanh says, if you cannot do the dishes to do the dishes, then you cannot drink the cup of tea either. Because when you go to drink the cup of tea, you're going to be thinking of the next thing that you want to do. When I get through this tea, then I've got to go straighten up the bedroom, or I've got to make 2 phone calls. And we're always kind of falling into the future and not mindful of the present moment. So as you're doing the dishes, he is suggesting that you be fully conscious of everything that's in front of you, and that's the most important thing in the world to you at that moment. The light as it plays on the bubbles of the soap, the feel of the water, that may not be just a terrible task that you have to do, but as something very very important. Another story from Thich Nhat Hanh that involves Jim Forrest. I know he tells two stories about Jim Forrest. He taught Jim a lot of things. He said one time Thich Nhat Hanh came to the United States, and the two of them were sitting under a tree, and they were discussing the peace movement and making plans for things that they were going to be doing in the future. And they had tangerines that they were sitting there eating. So Thich Nhat Hanh said, I watched Jim as he was involved in thinking about the future and involved in his plans and what he was going to do, and he had peeled the tangerine and he'd broken off one of the sections and he stuffed it in his mouth and he's talking and he's before that's all chewed up, he's got another tangerine beginning to shove it in his mouth. Now, I've got a 13 or 14 year old son who eats like that. And we're always, perhaps we can't expect that he yet can be mindful of what he's eating. But that's the way Jim was eating the tangerine. And Thich Nhat Hanh gently said to him, Jim, why don't you eat the section of the tangerine that you're eating first before you begin the next one? And I don't know, he didn't say it maybe quite like that, but that's the sense of the words. And then Jim realized what he'd been doing. And Thich Nhat Hanh's sort of analysis or comment on that was that Jim was not eating the tangerine. He was eating his future plans. That's what he was doing as he was popping pieces of tangerine into his mouth. So Thich Nhat Hanh, in this little kind of Eastern mentality, says, if you can't eat one section of the tangerine, then you can't eat the tangerine. These things are important. These little things are important because sometime later, Jim Forrest was jailed for some activity that he had engaged in the peace movement. And Thich Nhat Hanh wrote him a letter, just a brief little note. And Jim was in jail, and he said, Dear Jim, remember the day we sat under the tree eating the tangerines? While you're being in jail is like the tangerine. Eat one day at a time and be one with it. And that's what it means to be mindful. The world teaches us in a lot of subtle ways and not so subtle ways the opposite of that. While I was still in Kalamazoo before I came here, I was driving down a road and I saw a great big billboard, and it was a beer commercial. I'll just use this as one illustration because it's so clear. I thought it was clear anyway. Here was a man in this on the billboard. He had his big stein of beer and the nice foam was running down the side of it, and I forgot the name of the beer, Michelob or something. And the caption on the billboard said, for that part of the day which is yours. I got to thinking about that, and I thought, boy, there's a tremendous philosophy behind that one slogan. That implies that there are some parts of the day which are not mine. For that part of the day which is yours, and that conjures up minds, I've worked 8 hours, now I come home, now I've got some time to myself. The kids have gone outside to play, now I got this little piece of the day which is mine, and I can sit down and enjoy this beer. Mindfulness is making all of the day yours, not just the time when you think of it as relaxation or time away from work. Let me say it again and say it in a slightly different way, which is so simple, I suppose, but walking on the earth is a miracle of which we are very often not mindful. And I confess, it's hard for me to talk even about these things because I am such a rank beginner in this myself, but I'm beginning to become aware that walking on the earth is a miracle. And it's a miracle that we often lose because we are not mindful, because we're eating the future. We're off someplace else. And people might think that it would be a miracle to walk on water. Jesus walked on water. Peter did it for a little while and then fell in. Or to be able to walk on the air like Mary Poppins, what a miracle that would be. I think it would be a miracle if we really walked on the earth. Really walked on the earth. That is a miracle. And if we could do that even for 10 minutes, that is absolute miraculous. To be aware and to be mindful of each step. The very act of walking is a miracle and is a parable. And those of us who have good legs and can do it without even thinking, mindlessly. Like, how do you walk? You take a step, and each step is born out of the death of the step before it. And if you think about yourself as walking along, as you take a step, that's a new thing, a new beginning, and it slowly moves backwards and dies, and in order for the next step to really be born, that one has to die, and a new one comes. And as we walk along that way, is a parable of death and resurrection at our very feet. Well, perhaps we think we're too busy to be mindful like this all the time. Then it's all the more reason to be mindful. Mindfulness isn't just focusing on our bodily functions, it's being fully alert and fully aware and fully conscious of the work that's at our hand. I said yesterday, and I'm going to reiterate a little bit here, that our breathing is perhaps what the primary bodily function that we have that will prevent dispersion, that prevents our minds from wandering off. And that means being mindful of our breath. So if we begin to feel scattered and we begin to feel like we're losing control of our presence to the situation, one way to bring it back is to take control of our breath. And I'm going to have us do that right now just for a few seconds, only a few seconds, but this would be something which needs to be practiced over a long period of time before it begins to have a cumulative effect on us, but this is going to be stupidly simple. But again, sitting up, let's attempt to do some breathing and to be simply aware of the breath. And I will. It's going to be a little hard for me to do it because I want to say some words while you're doing it. As you take a long breath in, think of the words, "I am taking in a long breath." And then as you exhale, "I am letting out, I am breathing out a long breath." Let's do a few of those. And you breathe as I speak. I am breathing in a long breath. I am breathing out a long breath. I am breathing in a long breath. I am breathing out a long breath. I am breathing in a long breath. I am breathing out a long breath. Let me stop speaking. You do it now in your own mind and just become very conscious of that breathing, because we don't all breathe at the same speed. Okay. Jim Carroll has written a poem about this, and I'd like to share the poem. Perhaps some of you have heard this poem already. I read it a long time ago, and I loved it. But I begin to see that there is a literal truth as well as a poetic truth in the poem. He says, the title of it is "Sighs Too Deep for Words." Like ourselves, when we try to love each other, air blows cold and hot. We are left wondering if our passions were mistaken, if our loneliness in the end everything. And God? Like ourselves, when we are distant and close at once, He confuses us. Like ourselves, he begins his story with an eye-catching title and then fools us, fading, leaving us asking if this pain we cannot avoid, though we try, is yearning after him or yearning after yearning. Is God my pious name for guilt? You ask, how do you pray when it's all so foggy? But it's not foggy at all, don't you see? It is clear as air. Prayer. How I pray is breathe. I remember the poet Paul, who couldn't shake the faith either, saying, "Praying? Forget praying. The Spirit, breath of God, lives in you, in your bones, in your heart, interrupting God for you all day. Relax. Don't worry about it. The Spirit prays for you with sighs too deep for words. Paul, baby, I could kiss you for those lines, which come, I suspect, more from your insane desire like mine than from any facts you had. Sighs like that, I know them out. If you tell me those sighs are the breath of God praying, I can believe it. I can believe it. My sighs are warm and cool, death and life, far and near. My sighs always surprise me, for a sigh is what happens when the breath I breathe is not all mine. How I pray is breathe, knowing the air that brings the world into my soul escapes its hedge with more of me than I knew was there. Mindfulness of our breath is beginning to realize that that's really true, that that is how we pray. Prayer begins with God. It doesn't begin with us. It doesn't begin with words. And so often I think we have our prayer caught up with words. So how we breathe is prayer, and that's really important. In a sense, breath begins at the navel and ends at the nostrils, not the other way around. So I would suggest, when if you do take time to pray and meditate, you sit down for a time in the morning or the time in the evening, and I suggest that you're not going to get any place unless you do have some disciplined time like that, that you always begin by gaining control of your breath, perhaps 10 breaths, and just focus on those breaths. Mindfulness is letting each thing that we do be the most important thing we're doing. And a way to constantly bring ourselves back and gain control of that concept is one way is through our breathing. And so then it can be, it begins to spill over into other things. The dishes, we do the dishes to do the dishes. I know a woman who said, it's not important to me, but I know when I go home, I will mow the grass to mow the grass. I mean, she didn't exist during the time she mowed the grass because she didn't like doing that. Or chopping wood, or washing your hands, the act of washing your hands. Let's see what the time is, 11:28. Now, the purpose of mindfulness, of being mindful, is not to construct some philosophical system of the interdependence of things. That's a danger, I think, in what I did yesterday with meditating on the chair, is that we somehow then begin to construct some philosophical system of how everything is interdependent. Practicing mindfulness in our daily life is so that we can enter into the harmony of life. It's an experiential kind of thing, not intellectual. It's a means to something. Here is an exercise that we won't do here, but something that you might, I mean, I could give a bunch of exercises now that you might do in terms of meditation, but one would be to meditate on a photo of yourself as a child. Sit down for 10 minutes and put in front of you, if you have a photograph from your album, of yourself as a child, and meditate on who am I, and not let that be an intellectual exercise. First of all, gain control of your breathing and let your mind become simple. And let the question of who you are be deeply rooted within you as you meditate on a photograph of yourself. Not discursive, not sitting and letting your mind talk about abstractions, but following your breath, and for about 10 minutes, meditate on that. I brought a page of my journal here that I'd like to share with you because I think it has something to do with mindfulness. Nancy, who had to leave to go do something else, was sitting in the back, is my wife, and she's a physical therapist, and she works with handicapped infants from the age from birth to 3, and I know from watching her with handicapped children how mindful she is of these children. And there was a picnic out of the school where she works late in June, and I went to the picnic, and here are the parents, and all the children there have various kinds of physical disabilities. And there's one little child in particular that Nancy was paying a lot of attention to, and holding this child and so forth, and I had a chance to sit and look at that that little child with cerebral palsy, and I wrote this down in my journal. It has to do with Nancy, particularly, I think, more than anything else. I looked into the large brown eyes of a cerebral palsy child tonight and saw Christ. A beautiful, sad, happy face. A tear came to the corner of his left eye and rolled down the cheek, but he wasn't crying. He was smiling. I watched Nancy hold him and feed him Jell-O. She knows him. By that I mean she has a deep mindfulness of this child. She knows him almost in a biblical sense. I mean, not just on the surface. She aches for him too. Her love for these children is real because she has given herself. The suffering of the child is transformed in the presence of such love. It is still there, but it is transformed, even if for 1 second. And if for 1 second, then for eternity. So mindfulness is not an end in itself. It is a way in which we begin to become compassionate, to begin to feel with someone. One time I did a study, it was a long time ago, but it was kind of an exegetical, biblical study of the miracles of Jesus, and how Jesus healed people. And if you do that sometime, look it up in the scriptures, and you'll find that almost every time that a miracle of healing takes place on the part of Jesus, the text somehow begins with words like this: and Jesus, looking upon the person, had compassion on him and said, stretch forth your hand, or something. Jesus' powers of healing are literally mobilized by compassion. Now, I'm saying, I've used a different word here. I've used the word mindfulness. I think Jesus probably was the epitome of mindfulness. And they could move totally into the suffering and the feelings of that person in front of him. And almost always, the New Testament writers will put those words in. Jesus felt pity and compassion. I like the word compassion better because pity is now getting a little negative connotations in our mind. But compassion means to feel with. And that's what motivated Jesus. Another exercise that we might attempt to do, and in fact, if we got time to do it, we could probably even touch upon it a little bit here, is for us to meditate on the person that you hate or despise the most. Now this could be a kind of a painful meditation exercise, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that if we're interested in making peace, the place to start is right where we are and with the person that we have the most difficulty. And I would suggest that this is how we would do it, that we would first of all sit quietly and gain control of ourselves and maybe follow our breath for a few moments. Well, let's do it. let's just take about 5 minutes, and I'll just sort of walk through this. Why don't you just sort of get yourself relaxed and breathing centered, and then begin to conjure up in your mind a person. And if you don't have any person that you dislike, despise, or who bothers you, then there's, I don't believe that. I might suggest that you practice that meditation, that same meditation with that same person over and over again. I mean, just doing this for 2 minutes here is it's just almost like a simulation game. But that you do this deeply for 10 minutes, let's say. I'm going to stop and see. I better stop and see where any questions or thoughts or insights might be. Go ahead, just jump in.
I think if I would have listened to you a year ago, I don't think I can appreciate what you're trying to get at. For me, I got into running, and I didn't get into it just for my health. I got into it for a release, for a need. And so for me, having done this now for some time, that is the reason that I do it. For me, the first, it takes 15 minutes, up to 30, even to get into it, to feel. And I don't run for my health. I run for the meditation. I run for what I like what you were saying, which I feel I can feel, particularly in prayer, is that I still pray, but the prayer in relationship to meditation for me through running, it's an automatic feeling of a prayer that comes. And I just concentrate, I can feel my body, I can feel the steps, the breathing. But there's some runners, a lot of publishing of books, Sheehan is one, where he goes so far that he makes then the running a religion. And I think that's what you were getting into, is saying that that can become dangerous, where the actions and part of that actually becomes the religion, and that's where, for me, I have to watch that runners naturally run alone, they become lonely people a lot. They admit that. That's why for me, I try to run with people as often as I can, because I get enough alone running, but yet in that running, it just sort of happens in you. It just sort of feels. A lot of runners have talked about this euphoria that they enter in. A lot of them don't really understand what that is, and particularly if they're not Christian runners. It naturally starts coming and speaking to you. Mm-hmm. It's exciting what you begin to feel. I suppose others can't get that through walking or whatever, but for me in running, it takes at least 15 minutes before I even get myself there. And the neat part about it is, I was telling Molly this the other day, is that in terms of with you, it's with the dishes, when you do the dishes, for doing the dishes. Like my wife passed away 9 months ago, and that's why I got into running. For me now, for doing the dishes, you gain far more than doing the dishes for doing the dishes. Because I miss the whole thing around the sink with the women, of what that means for doing the dishes. You're doing the dishes to get the dishes clean. But the interaction that you have with the people in doing the dishes is as important as doing the dishes. And that can be the same as maybe the different forms of meditation or for me in running. The running is for running, but that running is for doing something. And like for me now, I'm trying to take a whole year off to set back. And I've been a person who just believed in making things happen. And to just set back and listen to what that is, and then the withdrawal symptoms on that was something tremendous for the first 3 months. Now I worry that I'm sitting back too much and becoming too much of a listener. It's exciting, but I don't want to get captured into a philosophy or what she is trying to do to keep things in perspective. But you can, I would think, I don't know, I would ask you a question where I was finally going to come from my own personal concern, if you think through this meditation and doing that, that a person can get really stretched out away from people and start becoming alone if they really get into it, I would see that potential for me where I could get into that so deep and in the running game so much and get enjoying that feeling where I can take off and after I get in for 15, 20 minutes, I can run for an hour and a half, and I'm back and I don't even remember where I've been other than I know I went up and all of a sudden I'm back because you're so deep in that meditation. I don't know if you experience that when people then do start getting to become alone and getting away from people, which are considered to be a problem. Just raising that.
Don't know that I have an answer to it. I think it's a danger, yeah. Mm-hmm. But the point is to be present to the moment. And that involves being present to people. Yeah, that's a danger. I guess it needs to be, you're aware of it. That's already overcoming it practically.
But isn't it at the same time emptying your mind, becoming aware of yourself and oneness with everything, then you are prepared to go out to our daily life, interacting with people, understanding better. So that's the way I feel about it.
I need to say our time is up. I see, you know, people need to leave, and I'm willing to stay, but people should feel free to be able to go an hour or so. I need to say that so that people are comfortable to go.
I was interested in what the other man said, because I do some running. I do walking for the same purpose as he does running. Mm-hmm. And I can use myself just like he does. It's quite a while. Maybe go 6 miles.
Mm-hmm. And none of these things, I guess, are ends in themselves. That's the thing to keep in mind. It's not an end in itself. As soon as it becomes an end in itself, then it becomes a religion.
I was interested in something you said at the very beginning of the session about we teach our children to look, but do we teach them to really see? And is there a way that you can really teach people to see, or is this something that comes and is a gift that is acquired? Or how would I go about teaching and helping my children to really see?
I think that my reaction to the question would be sort of like this. First of all, you must see. And that if you see, that's an example already.
So it's something that they acquire. I mean, there isn't a... Just from your example of how you are, they will learn this. But it isn't something that you can just... There's a method, 1, 2, 3 steps.
I don't think so. I don't sense that that's not the most important way. Negatively, we can try to check ourselves from teaching our children to look at the surface of things. And we do that sometimes. I can stop doing that. Children see much better than we do. I mean, if you want to go on and really want to see things, you go for a walk with a little child. Because they're not all messed up yet. I mean, they don't have all the prejudices that... For a little child, I mean, how does a little child know that a mouse is yucky? I mean, they don't. A mouse isn't yucky to a 3-year-old unless it's been taught that it's yucky. And a child will teach us to see. Pablo Picasso, a great 20th century artist, one time went to an exhibit of children's artwork. And he walked around and he looked at all this, and he was an old man by that time. And his comment about the children's artwork was, "I have worked for 50 years to learn how to paint like that."
I would think that little children would understand the differences between looking and seeing.
Yeah, those are abstractions that my adult mind throws out. That you're right.
In your chapter in that book of awareness that you were commenting on, just opened a page to it yesterday after our session in the library. didn't read it all, but with my experience as a school teacher, there are ways to help children become aware of things, text, touching, seeing, listening, closing eyes, and so on, that I think young parents can actually do with children, and they get a little of that in kindergarten. It may not be, refined as what we're talking about now, but I think it's the beginnings.
I think children are naturally mindful. I think what we do is shut that down.
Yes.
And I think if we could stop shutting that down, that's the answer, rather than trying to make them mindful. In so many ways, I walked with my niece and we were going to the water yesterday. She's a little redhead, maybe 3 years old. And I said, let's go for a walk down to the bridge. And every time she'd stop to look at a rock or a chipmunk or whatever, I'd say, come on, I'm going to the bridge. And it's all those subtleties to teach them not to be mindful.
You see, she was doing the dishes to do the dishes, and you wanted to do the dishes to get on to the tea. That's right, and she taught you. But see, the wonderful thing about it is that you're mindful that that's what happened.